First case on our calendar is 09-1149, State of Ohio versus James Leslie Dye. Mr. Bartolotta.
Mr. Chief Justice Moyer, Justices, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Mark Bartolotta. I'm here on behalf of the County Prosecuting Attorney Charles Colson, representing the appellant, State of Ohio, on this matter. Also with me today is Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Terry Daniel. We're here today for a particular purpose to answer the question, when is it required that the prosecution in a case reserve the right to bring further charges on a matter such as this, where a victim subsequently dies from injuries sustained originally from the criminal act that occurred, in this case, several years prior. The 11th District's decision on this case, it injects confusion into this matter in an area of law that has already been well settled by this court. It sets a dangerous precedence that is contrary to this court's decision, particularly in the case of State versus Carpenter that was handed down back in 1993 by this court. In that regard, the state contends that the 11th District misinterpreted and misapplied Carpenter to the facts of this particular case. What we had here, obviously, was the aggravated vehicular assault conviction that occurred in 1999, shortly after the victim, Robbie Arnold, was struck and injured by the drunk driver, the appellee, Mr. Dye. He did serve an 18-month sentence on that vehicular assault charge, and unfortunately, several years later, Robbie Arnold did die as a result of the injuries sustained in that crash. And the state did present the case back to the grand jury in Lake County, and it was indicted on the aggravated vehicular homicide charges.
Why wouldn't, as a matter of caution, a prosecutor always reserve rights, knowing that Carpenter is out there and knowing that some of these issues can have some factual twists to them like this one does?
As a matter of caution, probably in hindsight, that would have been a good course of action to take. However, the state's belief at the time was that Carpenter relieved us of that duty at that time because there was no plea bargain in the case. As the Carpenter case was fact-specific regarding a case where there was a negotiated plea agreement to lesser offense, and we didn't have that here. We had a plea to the indictment, maximum sentence, so there was no plea bargaining.
And you argue that the dismissal of the other two indictments is sort of a nullity or immaterial because they didn't add anything to the case?
Exactly. They weren't charges themselves. They were specifications which were used for enhancement purposes, and there were three of them that were initially charged. The first one was pled to. The second two added nothing to the charge itself. They all involved the conviction being, or the offense occurring while the defendant was DUI, while he was DUS, and that he had a prior DUI offense.
Would they have resulted in additional time had all three specifications been found guilty of?
No, absolutely not. The only thing that they did, all of them made it mandatory prison, all three of the specs, mandatory prison, still within the same range, at that time a fourth degree felony, 6 to 18 months. So that didn't add any additional time, and they couldn't have been compounded or stacked because they were all contained on the one charge. The spec that he did plead guilty to also had the addition that it had a mandatory lifetime driver's license revocation, where the other two specs didn't. So he pled to the highest level of specifications as well. The other two specifications couldn't be stacked, wouldn't have added additional time or any additional penalty on
that. So in your viewpoint, he gained nothing other than the fact that he didn't go to trial, which is his choice.
Correct, correct. He gained nothing from his plea. There was no concessions made by the state. We gave up nothing, no reductions, no charges dismissed, and no agreement to ask for anything but the maximum sentence.
Mr. Bartolotta, it's my understanding that in Carter, we determined that a plea, Carter bars a defendant's indictment for the later death of a victim after the court accepts a negotiated plea. Is that your understanding of what Carpenter stands for?
It does. I agree that is what Carpenter stands for.
So is the determination for our court to make then in this case whether or not there was a negotiated plea. Is that the singular issue we need to focus on, in your view?
That is one of the issues.
What other issue besides whether it's a negotiated plea?
Well, the other issue is the definition of negotiated plea to a lesser offense is the other issue, where I believe that the 11th District misunderstood.
You think negotiated plea must imply a lesser offense and not the indicted offense?
Correct. A lesser offense or a separate count dismissed, but something less than the maximum that was charged.
When I looked at the colloquy at the time that the court accepted the plea, the following is contained among the transcript responses. The court indicates you want to continue bond. I was considering canceling his bond, likely because this was a mandatory period of incarceration. Am I correct, based on the specification?
It was a mandatory term of incarceration.
So the court indicates it was considering canceling bond, and the court says, had you made an agreement? The state responds, I assume bond was continued. We represented to the defendant that would happen. And then further, the court says, you would recommend that. The state says, yes. The court says, you were involved with the case, were you not? And the response is, yes. That's what we agreed to. Why shouldn't we read the agreement made in response to the court on the record as part of an inducement to the defendant to have him resolve it by way of a plea instead of going to trial or requiring production of evidence? And why shouldn't that be some negotiation between the state and the defense counsel?
Well, the quick question is, the issue of bond does not affect the issue of what was pled to and what negotiation, if any, there was on the actual plea itself.
But if a defendant is determining whether he should or shouldn't enter a plea, and an inducement is offered, and at least an inducement of a continuation of bond, that may be enough to propel a defendant to decide to enter a plea. And it is part of the, and that's why I focused initially on Carpenter, the negotiated plea.
The bond itself, continuation of the bond, would not have reduced his sentence. It just would have postponed it. There was no evidence in the record. There was no testimony. There was no statement that defendant relied on the bond.
But without that, he would have chosen not to.
Well, we don't know that, and I don't think we ever will. In this particular case, there was a visiting judge who was taking the plea.
Who didn't understand the custom or practice in
right.
your court. I understand all of that. But the question is, if we're only looking at what a negotiation is, seems like there was some here. And the duty on the state is to reserve the right to indict at a later point. That's what Carpenter says. And if you don't reserve it, you don't have it.
But Carpenter limits it to a negotiated plea to a lesser offense, and we did not have that here. We had a plea to the indictment, to the maximum charge, and to the maximum sentence. So while there may arguably have been some discussion of continuation of a bond, that does not equate to a negotiated plea to a lesser offense.
So your view is, unless there's a lesser offense, it's not a negotiated plea?
Either a lesser offense or some concession by the state, something given up by the state.
That helps me clarify your position.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Counsel, I think there's some question about a lesser offense of what. And the crux of, I think, the 11th District is it's a lesser. The offense, the assault offense, is lesser than the homicide, and they're referencing that. And I guess traditionally it's been analyzed and applied in a manner that it is a lesser offense of the charge that was pending at the time the defendant entered their plea.
Exactly.
Now, would you address that?
Yes, that was the second issue I was alluding to earlier. That is exactly correct. All the case law that addresses this particular type of issue did focus on a lesser offense to the charges that were pending at the time of the plea. I agree with you 100% on that. In this case, the 11th District looked beyond that, looked to the ultimate charge that he was charged with later, to the aggravated vehicular homicide, and ruling that, well, anything that he pled to on the original indictment would have been lesser to this homicide.
But isn't it also true that lesser offense had to be a negotiated, and there was no negotiation here? In other words, it wasn't negotiated that we're not going to charge you with a homicide because the homicide hadn't occurred.
Right.
I mean, the death hadn't occurred at the time the plea. So I'm a little confused about the ability to address a crime that hadn't been committed at the time of the plea and base an opinion on that.
Exactly. And how could we? We couldn't foresee whether or not robbery was going to pass due to the injuries. Certainly he was in bad condition at the time, but he did appear at the sentencing. He did speak at the sentencing. He lived as full a life as he could given his injuries with the help of his mother and family members. And but I agree, we couldn't predict when or if he would succumb to these injuries caused by this accident. So in that regard, the 11th District, looking at the ultimate charge, I think misinterpreted Carpenter in finding that the aggravated vehicular homicide was the pinnacle, and we looked to the lesser charges.
Counsel, could you address Criminal Rule 11C, the idea of the defendant understanding what is happening as a consequence of the plea? It seems to me that it would have been very easy for the prosecutor to say, and you understand if there's any complications here, we are reserving the right to come back. I mean, this is, isn't there a reasonable expectation based on what was said at the time of the sentence that this was the result of what his conduct was, the consequences of what he did, he was being sentenced for? And the prosecutor could have easily explained or had the judge explain that there was a reservation of rights.
I don't disagree with that. It could have easily been accomplished, but I think what we have to focus on was whether it was required. And what this court has determined subsequent to Carpenter in Zima, and then again recently in Harrison, talking about Carpenter, Harrison was last July, was the expectation of finality by the defendant reasonable? Was it reasonable? And in this case, I would submit that that expectation was not reasonable based on the track record of the case as it progressed up until that point in time. We had the charges indicted by the grand jury. The state's position was, you're pleading to the charges as charged, and we're asking for the maximum sentence. The defendant's own viewpoint was that Robbie was hurt very badly, and throughout the course of this case, they have presented themselves to believe that it was inevitable, almost, that he was going to succumb to the injuries. So with that mindset back at the time, why would it be reasonable for him to believe that, based on how we were pursuing this to the fullest extent of the law, that should Robbie pass and expire, that we wouldn't pursue that charge further? That was unreasonable for him to expect that. And I think that's what Zima and Harrison talk about, is that expectation. Is it reasonable for them to expect that we were going to just wash our hands of it and walk away from it? And I submit that it was not reasonable for him to consider that.
Even though it was not said.
Yes. Yes, I agree. And along those lines, what's interesting to note is that the defense in this case from the start has focused on and made a big issue of the fact that they did almost expect that Robbie would expire. They presented an affidavit from Cuyahoga County coroner who talked about life expectancy of a quadriplegic who has these respiratory problems. And they focused on that in their case. And I think that enhances our argument that they shouldn't have expected that we would not pursue the charge if Robbie did in fact expire from the cause of the accident. So in that regard, and looking at the Carpenter case in light of Zima and Harrison, expectation was not reasonable for them to believe that we wouldn't pursue the charge later. The result of this ruling by the 11th District is that it's going to set precedents in the 11th District and perhaps other districts around the state that will perhaps follow that, that is contrary to Carpenter. And Carpenter was very specific. Carpenter said, to a lesser offense, a negotiated plea to a lesser offense. So in that regard, I believe that this court should reverse that decision of the 11th District, reinstate the conviction, and have the conviction stand on the vehicular homicide.
You see no double jeopardy concerns whatsoever in this situation? One accident,
no
two
double
prosecutions.
Jeopardy. Yes, the additional element hadn't been met at the time of the original plea in 99. The additional element of the death of Robbie didn't occur until 2006, and that is what would have been needed for the vehicular homicide charge, obviously, back then. So case law is pretty clear on that, that there's no double jeopardy since that element hadn't been achieved yet, so to speak. And I think I have 2 seconds left if anyone has any.
Thank you, Mr. Bartolotta. Right.
Thank you very much.
The appellee, Mr. Dye, has waived oral arguments, so the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
Thank you.